I hope you enjoyed today's show, and hopefully you'll join me next week as I try to simplify for you the third world debt crisis. My guest speakers will include Professor Jorge Neff of the Politics Department and Professor Truman Phillips, an agricultural economist. Each week, Interconnections looks at issues of global concern and how Canadians can be involved. If you would like to make any comments or suggestions, or if you would like to volunteer with production, call the Guelph International Resource Center at 822-3110 or at CFRU. The number is 824-4120, extension 6919. Tonight's technical operations by Laurie Guest. I'm your host and producer, Zorka Rosales. Good night. Good evening, this is Interconnections, I'm Zorka Rosales. Interconnections is sponsored by the Guelph International Resource Center, a community group whose mandate is to encourage dialogue and action around international development issues. Interconnections brings to you issues of global concern every week. On today's show, we'll look at an improving Canadian policies in the third world. Mr. Bill Weingard speaks on the Weingard Report. A report was issued from the Standing Committee of External Affairs and International Trade on May of 1987, titled, For Whose Benefit? The Standing Committee is composed of 11 members from the three major political parties. The purpose for the report was an in-depth analysis of Canada's present development aid policies to the Third World and how it can be improved. Chairman for the committee is Guelph's Member of Parliament, Mr. William Weingard. In the introduction to the report, he wrote, I hope that we will be successful in helping to change the emphasis from the building of things to human development, for short-term projects to long-term relationships, and above all, from Ottawa-centered decision-making to doing development in the field. Otherwise known as the Weingard Report, good evening, this is Interconnections, I'm Zorka Rosales. Interconnections is sponsored by the Guelph International Resource Center, a community group whose mandate is to encourage dialogue and action around international development issues. Interconnections brings to you issues of global concern every week. This week, I bring to you a taped interview of Charles Bassett, CETA's Vice President for Anglophone Africa. Last Thursday, I had a chance to tape a meeting held at the Arboretum Center with a special guest hosted by the Ontario African Working Group, Mr. Charles Bassett. Mr. Bassett is the Canadian International Development Agency's Vice President for Anglophone Africa. The Ontario African Working Group, or OAWG, is a coalition of non-governmental organizations in Ontario that have development education interests or implemented programs in the continent of Africa. Charles Bassett has been CETA's Vice President for Anglophone Africa since 1982. He is responsible for all CETA's programs in those countries. Canada extends aid to Africa through three channels. 1. Bilateral, that is government-to-government aid. 2. Multilateral, that is when Canada supports the efforts of international organizations such as the United Nations or Organization for African Unity. And thirdly, through non-governmental organizations. During the past 6 years, Mr. Bassett mentions there has been a deeper emphasis on the countries of Angola, Mozambique, South Africa, and the frontline states, located from the Northeast to Central Africa. Now, one of the major ways Canada contributes to Africa is through sending food. However, this has become a controversial method due to recent political developments in countries like Ethiopia, for example. The government of the country will limit the quantity of foreign food aid passing through, and it sometimes does this by violent methods.
The Ontarians' Constitution mandates us to teach anyone who wishes to learn any aspect of newspaper production how to do it.
This is not a love song.
We want to continue to do that, but we need your support.
Pump up the volume.
On February 29th, March 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, we're running a referendum for an increased fee so that we can plan for our future and keep our autonomy.
Hey Chuck, we got some non-believers out there.
We'd like $1.20 more from every undergraduate per semester.
Ooh, sometimes.
Right now, the Ontarian is the only student newspaper in Canada that is completely independent.
The agony of defeat.
We feel it's important to remain autonomous in order to publish exactly what students at the University of Guelph feel is important.
The thrill of victory.
But we can't do it without you. On February 29th, March 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, stand up for the serious paper that doesn't take itself seriously. Please, say yes.
You're one of my kind.
Why did I hear anything?
This wasn't
up. Wasn't it? I'm not sure what it is, but I
did. Oh, did you? Oh.
Try again.
Isn't that
weird?
The Ontarian is the official student newspaper of the University of Guelph. We need your help. We need an extra $1.20 per semester. Please say yes. What do you get for $1.20? Letters, opinions, news, sports, entertainment, Dear Renee, Dear Deirdre, unclassifieds. It's all yours. Support a tradition. On February 29th and March 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, please say yes. Hi, this is not Michael Bill. Hi, this is not Michael Bell of the Brick, but this is the Ontarian, the official student newspaper of the University of Guelph. On February 29th, March 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, the Ontarian is asking all full-time students to cop up an extra $1.20. We need you. What do you get for that? Letters, opinions, news, sports, entertainment, Renee, Deirdre, unclassifieds. It's all yours. Support a tradition. On February 29th and March 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, say yes to the Ontarian.
You have been listening to Youssef Saloudji of the African National Congress. I'm Stephen Potter, and I've been your host for this segment of Interconnections. Technical assistance for the show was provided by Fraximus Beluga, and the music in the center was from Lesotho, given to me by Kathy Williams. Tune in next week.
Each week, Interconnections looks at issues of global concern and how Canadians can get involved. If you have any topic that you think Interconnections should look at, or if you would like to help with production, call the Guelph International Resource Centre at 822-3110 or CFRU at 824-4120, extension 6919. This has been Interconnections. I'm Joanne Citrino.
The previous description, Dr. Yano confessed, was to a massive Israel attack on the 16th to 18th of September 1982 in southern Lebanon. There is mounting evidence that Israel's behavior with its neighboring countries, as well as Palestinians, violates human rights and global peace. Subordinating Palestinians within Israel, threats to Lebanon and Syria of invasion, and presently the heavy violence in the Gaza Strip and West Bank, is cause for concern by groups such as the United Nations.
Most people are aware that Israel has invaded Lebanon two times, but in fact there is a third invasion. Back in 1948-1949, during Israel's War of Independence, the Israelis clashed with the Lebanese army and in fact invaded Lebanon and seized a fair portion of southern Lebanon and actually acquired a foothold on the Litani River. However, due to external considerations, they withdrew. One of the factors was, of course, that the French government viewed itself as the protector of Lebanon, and the Israelis did not want a military clash with France at that time. Similarly, in 1978, there was Operation Litani. This occurred shortly after Israel signed the Camp David Peace Accords. This, in effect, removed Egypt from the Middle East military equation. And again, in June 1982, after there was a 10-month truce with the PLO. This truce, in fact, was violated by the Israelis. Sharon discussed the invasion of Lebanon months prior to the invasion. And in fact, I have in my possession an article from the Toronto Star where Prime Minister Begin talks about the spontaneous planned invasion of Lebanon. Now, the pretext that Israel invaded Lebanon was in fact the assassination attempt on the Israeli ambassador to Britain, Shlomo Argov. This in fact was conducted by Abu Nidal, which is an anti-PLO organization, but this provided the pretext. But from the historical record, and even from the verbal record, from the Israeli press and even the Western press, I remember reading in the London Free Press that Israel was contemplating an invasion of Lebanon to eliminate the PLO's political and social infrastructure. Now, there's two other considerations in terms of understanding and explaining Israel's armed intervention into a neighboring state. One is that the Zionists had this wish for natural borders. And also there's another overriding consideration in that water is very scarce in the Middle East. It's a semi-arid region of the world. You know, Israel has made the desert blooms. They've neglected to mention that there's going to be a severe water crisis in Lebanon by the year 2000, or in Israel by the year 2000. Because all the groundwater from the West Bank and elsewhere is going to be used up. In the 1978 invasion, they built roads into Lebanon, and in fact they brought engineers in to investigate the possibility of diverting rivers in southern Lebanon into Israel. And in fact, this is one of the major operative motives of Israel's invasion.
As the resistance built with the urging of PLO leader Yasser Arafat, so did the accumulation of weapons on behalf of the Israelites. To suppress this revolt, Richard Falk details the amount of weapons. The three speakers tonight were taped at the Crimes of the Official Terror Network, a tribunal that took place a week before the Economic Summit in Toronto. The excerpt of the Palestinian peasant was taken from Rosemary Sayee's book, Palestinians, From Peasants to Revolutionaries. The conflict in the Middle East is always present, and current information will undoubtedly be in your daily paper and news shows. The Israeli troops left Lebanon in 1985-86. However, the Palestinians still live within refugee camps and in their surrounding countries, still resisting with their goal of regaining what they believe is their land. Each Each week, Interconnections looks at issues of global concern and how Canadians can be involved. If you would like to volunteer with production or have any suggestions or comments, please call the Guelph International Resource Centre at 822-3110 or at CFRU, the number is 824-4120, extension 6919. Tonight's technical operation by Laurie Guest. I'm your host and producer, Zorka Rosales. Good night. The Palestinian peasants resented the act of being pushed from their land in 1948. So after almost 20 years later, in 1967-68, they formed a liberation movement called the Palestinian Liberation Organization, or PLO. Their movement for resistance began, and their efforts became very clear as they revolted with the Lebanese forces when the Israelis invaded Lebanon. At this moment, most Palestinians were in refugee camps in southern Lebanon. The reason for Palestinians to have left what is now Israel is the fact that the Israelites brought with them a market economy that had U.S. support by trading. Thus, the relatively small Arab economic system could not compete nor survive within the same country. The political and religious tensions among the two groups was and continues to be volatile and threatening to each other. I will read an excerpt of a Palestinian refugee who describes his experience at the camp of Burj al-Shemali in Lebanon. We gathered not less than 50 or 60 villages in a large mass at the Burj al-Shemali, east of Tyre. Life was difficult, as many as 7 families to a tent, sometimes from different villages. Sharing a tent with strangers was painful for us because of our traditions. There weren't enough tents for everyone, so some families had to live in caves. There was sickness and overcrowding. Many old people and children died because of the bad conditions. We spent the winter there, and then, in the spring, they forced us to leave. We tried to refuse because Burj al-Shemali was close to Palestine, and we wanted to stay close to our country. Often 4 or 5 young men would risk death to go back over the border to our villages to get food. The Lebanese police came and told us we had to leave. They promised to settle us in better places, and they said they would struggle with us so we would go back to our homes. But after our experience with the Jahish al-Inkadin, we knew it was all lies. We were people from 60 different villages, and we insisted that we should all be moved together. But they distributed us, some to North Bekaa, some to Anhar and Karun. The 60 villages refused to be separated, so the police beat our old people and fired in the air to frighten us and force us to get into the trucks. They beat us with sticks and rifle butts. Our fate was to go to the barracks of Karun. We found some of our kin in Safuriyeh, already settled there. They told us that many had died that winter because the snow there had reached a meter or more. Provisions from Zaleh had been cut off. There had also been fighting between them and the neighboring villages when they'd gone out in the snow looking for a mouthful of bread. At the end of the summer, we made a strike within the refugees in Anhar to enforce the authorities to let us leave the Bekaa because of the hardness of the climate. This is something which we had to thank our parents for. They had forced them to allow us to leave Karun, so they moved us to Narq al-Bared camp. I remember that the day we arrived to Narq al-Bared, it was raining. There were women who had given birth to children in the trucks taking us from Karun to Narq. We found tents there, and they distributed us among them.